Call your attention to the book of Exodus. Exodus will be in chapter 1 and 2. We'll start off in 2, but go back to 1 and then come back to 2. When I think about my mom, this coming September, she will be gone 4 years. I think I buried her on September the 1st. And for a couple of months after she passed, I would leave the church on a Sunday night. When I'd get out on 78, I'd say, "Siri, call Mama." That was the way that I would just verbally give the command, and her phone number would pop. And then all of a sudden it would dawn on me. She's in heaven. She's not here. That happened on multiple occasions because every Wednesday and every Sunday, and then sometimes in the other days, I would talk to her every week. I think about the memories that I have of my mom. Chad was talking about the memories that we ought to have as far as like mothers putting something spiritual into you. How many of you underline or highlight Bible verses in your Bible? Most of you, okay. Now, I've known of people and they just did not want to mark their Bibles up. All right, that was just, they felt like that was a sign of disrespect. I mark mine up all the time. I've got every color highlighter that they make. Sometimes when I'm preaching, if I don't necessarily have a set of notes with me and I know I want to change gears, they'll be yellow, they'll be blue, they'll be green. Sometimes there's pink, usually never red, but I'll just change gears in the text with different highlighters. But one of the things that I remember as a child, I remember the way that my mother marked verses in her Bible. She didn't underline, she didn't highlight, she circled. She would take an ink pen and she would go all the way around the verse that meant something to her. And when I look in her old Bible, I think I've still got it at in my office. If it's not at the office, it's at home. But when I look at that, I just look through that old Scofield Bible and I see those circled verses and I would go, "That's Mama's. That's Mama's. That's Mama's." Those were something that had meant so much to her. I can still remember as a little boy, my mother teaching Sunday school. I remember her and my dad singing in the choir. Now, I wasn't really paying attention to the songs that they sang because me and Doug Williams were sliding under the pews playing Man from U.N.C.L.E. We had string and we had rubber bands and we had all kind of stuff, and we're pulling stuff from pew to pew while they're having choir practice. But I still remember her standing in that choir and singing the songs of Zion. Those are good memories for me. I hope that one of these days when Deb and I's days are done on this earth, that our kids will look back and they'll have memories like that. I hope that my grandkids look back and they'll say, "Well, that's what Mimi would put up with and that's what she wouldn't put up with. That's what Papa liked, that's what he didn't like." I thought it was funny yesterday, our two older grandkids were a part of the group that came to our house to basically we had a cookout together. We didn't go outside, it just got cooked outside and then we ate inside. And Libby was razzing on Carter, who is the oldest, and about some girl that was interested in him. And this is what she said. She said, So what do you think Papa would have to say about that? And he was like, well, you know, she's not really my girlfriend or whatever, you know. And all I'm thinking is, you know, it's probably not Papa so much as it is Mimi. Because she's the grandmother. I know that when our grandkids started coming along, our kids wanted to know where their mother went to. I know that. But I can just remember story after story after story about my mom. I shared in Sunday school about one time I got the breath knocked out of me. My mother came flying out of the bleachers, jumped over the fence, went through my teammates to come out there to look right in my face to make sure I was living. And it embarrassed me to no end. I'd rather die. Just go away. I got lost one time at my great-grandparents' home. I was about maybe four. And there was a store kind of right across the railroad tracks. And me and my older cousin, Bobby, we were to go get her loaf of bread and bring it back. Well, we missed the turn to go to the store, and so we just started walking the railroad tracks. And I remember me and her walking, and I don't know why we weren't smart enough to turn around and just go back, but we just kept walking. The next thing I know, we see a figure coming down the railroad tracks from the far end in front of us. And I told Bobby, I said, I don't know who that is. She said, I don't either. So I reached down and I got some of those big rocks, like it's on a railroad track. And all I'm thinking, if this is a bad guy, I'm popping him and we're running. And I mean, I'm thinking that as a 4 or 5 year old kid. Well, you know who that figure was? It was my mama. But it wasn't just her looking for me. She, honest, as God is my witness, she had the GBI looking for me. She said, we got two kids missing. And I mean, they were looking for us, and she's the one that found us on that railroad track. Story after story. In the Friday Blast, I wrote, she loved us ferociously. That was a phrase that a dear friend of mine said to me when my mama died. She loved you ferociously. In other words, don't mess with her boy. Don't mess with her daughter. Those are my kids. I think that the lady that we're going to think about today, I think that she might have had a little Gloria in her. If you don't know who Gloria is, that's my mama's name. I think that Jochebed might have had a little Gloria in her. And so there's something about a mother's love. Now, daddy's love. I love my kids. I love my grandkids. I love them dearly. I want to hug them and all of that stuff. But I can't carry one of them kids for 3 hours. Yesterday our youngest grandchild, Charlie, he's like 4 months old now. And I held him for about 30 seconds and kissed him a couple of times and like, here you go. But what's Deb doing? He's walking all over that house holding that little baby. And I mean, he's a chunker. Matter of fact, Debbie named him Little Buddha. I mean, he got fat legs. He got a fat chin. He's fat. His dad's a good size fella, but you know, and his granddaddy is not little. But I'm telling you, I think that kid's legs bigger than mine. And she's just walking around holding that baby. Why? Because of a mother's love. There's something about a mother and the way that she nurtures. It's deeper than a dad's. Doesn't mean that dad doesn't love, but the way that it's expressed is different. That's where the old adage, mother's love is next to God's love, comes from. I don't know of very many things that, other than God's love, that is stronger than a mother's love. Many of you have experienced that as a kid. Maybe some of you came from a home where you did not experience that. But then you had a child of your own and you knew there was something maternally that just got that light switch flipped. And when I think about mothers, I think about what a beautiful, beautiful thing motherhood is. And I'm of the opinion there is no greater job that you women will ever have. If God blesses you with a child, there is no greater job that you will ever have than to be a mom. I make no apologies for saying that. It's more important for you to be a mom than it is for you to be a CEO of a major company. It's more important for you to be a mother and do it right than it is for you to have the greatest accolades that this world can ever give to you, because the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world, according to Billy Sunday. Abraham Lincoln said this. He said, "All that I am and ever will be, I owe to my darling mother." And you and I, we ought to celebrate mothers. That's why I'm disappointed that it's a 30-year-old that's the youngest mother here. All right? Now, we don't want 14-year-olds, but hey, when you get married, you say, "We can't afford it." You can if you don't buy a $40,000 pickup truck. You can if you don't buy a $70,000 SUV. Children are a blessing from God. They're an heritage from the Lord, Psalm 127. And so I want you to know that motherhood is to be celebrated, not shunned. The greatest job that you women will ever have, and the greatest job that you men, and I'll preach about this in a month, the greatest job you men will ever have is being a daddy. Now, my kids are grown. I got grandkids. But let me tell you something. I'd go back and be a dad again in a heartbeat. And so today I want us to look at a mother. Now, the same way that Gloria loved me and Caroline, I think that Jochebed loved Moses that way. My Aunt Wanda told me this years ago, and I laughed out loud when she told me this. She said, "You need to remember something about mothers and their children." She said, "Every blackbird thinks their babies are the blackest. And every mother thinks that their kid is the best." And rightly so. And so I want us to look, beginning in chapter 2 this morning, I want us to look at a slide first, and then we're going to begin reading in verse number 1 of chapter 2. In the early 1900s, this is a little over 100 years ago when this survey was taken. This was back when college was college, all right? I saw some people the other day on television. They were talking about, "I've got a degree in this and I got a degree in that." And the guy said, "Well, what are you going to do?" "Well, I don't know." One of them had a degree in, I think it was basket weaving, and somebody else had one in some type of gender study, and somebody else had one in a political science thing, and not a one of them had a job. Yet they were $70,000 in debt with student loans. Well, this was back when college was college, where you went to learn how to think and noodle things out and learn universal truths like 2 + 2 = 4, all right? 600 college students were asked to write what they thought was the most beautiful word in the English language. And out of the 600 that were asked, 422 wrote the word mother. Whose house do you go to on holidays? "Going to mama's house." Or, "I'm going to grandma's house." I don't remember as a kid growing up when we would go to the old farm down in South Georgia. I don't remember ever saying, "Well, I'm going to my papa's house." No, we're going to grandma's house. We're going to mama's house. And that's just the way it is, especially in the South. It's the matriarch that seems to be the glue that holds everything together. And so I want you to look with me beginning in verse 1. First thing we're going to see is we're going to see a goodly tribe. "And there went a man of the house of Levi." Now, you remember, if you back up into Genesis, you know that there was a man named Jacob. And Jacob had 12 sons. And these boys would become known as the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, we know who Reuben was, because Reuben was the firstborn. As a matter of fact, on Jacob's dying bed, he looked at his oldest boy and he said, "Reuben, you're as unstable as water." In other words, you just didn't have your life together, boy. We know who Judah was. He was like the fourth one. He would be the one that Messiah would come through his line. But about Levi, you know, he really was kind of like in the midst. He was just there. He was not somebody that was really back during the time of Jacob that was being revered a lot. Now, when Moses set up all of the encampments and would begin to say, well, you're going to have this place and that place, Levi was only given a little small area. Why? Because he put them in charge of the tabernacle. Later on, they would be in charge of the temple. But back whenever they were still moving through the wilderness, Levi was the guy in charge of the religious activities. We know that Aaron, who was 3 years older than Moses, was the first high priest. And so we've got this man that is of the tribe of Levi. We know that these people that were of that tribe, they had one job, and that was to honor God. It's like I tell our church all the time, we really have one job when it boils right down to it, make Jesus look good. That is our task as a Christian, make Jesus look good, because we are the only Bible that some people in the world ever read. They're never going to open the Word of God and see what the Bible has to say, but they're going to look at you because you named the name of Christ, and so it behooves you and me to make Jesus look good for our testimony's sake. And so this man that is unnamed here, this woman that is unnamed here, and there's a reason for that, I think. Ultimately, we will know by the time you get into chapter 6, you will know that the woman's name is Jochebed and the man's name is Amram. He is of the tribe of Levi and he marries this young girl. Now, they are in captivity. If you back up 300 years, you know that there was a man named Joseph. He was one of the boys of Jacob. He became a prime minister of Egypt. He saved the Egyptians, and ultimately, he saved his own family from starvation. His brothers had done him wrong. They had tried to basically get rid of him because his father showed favoritism to him by giving him the coat of many colors. He was sold into slavery. And he said, when he became a grown man, he said, boys, you meant it for bad, or you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. But now, 340 years have passed. And now, there is a Pharaoh that is on the throne of Egypt that does not know who Joseph was. Totally doesn't know the history of his own nation. He doesn't care one iota. That would be like some kid today saying, I don't give a rip what Thomas Jefferson did. I don't care what George Washington did. To me, that just shows a sign of being an ingrate. When you don't even know the people that preceded you, and why you have what you have today is because of what they put in play about almost 250 years ago. And yet you've got Joseph, he saved Egypt from starvation, and now they don't even remember what he did, and his people are now slaves. They are working under the taskmasters that we know as the Egyptians. But in the midst of all of that slavery and all of that bondage, we see that there is a man, there is a woman, and they conceive and they bear a son. And when she saw him, he was a goodly child. Can I tell you that I love the word goodly? All the modern translations, they don't use that word. They say, he was a fine child. He was a beautiful child. And I don't mind those words. When I talked about our grandkids earlier, and I don't know a lot about yours, so I'll tell you about mine. When Carter was born, the oldest, We're there in the room, and they handed him to me. And I've got his head in my hand there, and his little body is here. And all I'm thinking is this: that kid's got a huge head. That kid has got a massive head. And Debbie says, "Isn't he beautiful?" I said, "Did you see that head? That's a big head." She said, "He's beautiful." Like, you better tighten up. And I said, "I didn't say he wasn't beautiful. I just said he had a big head." But beautiful, fine, those are what commentators and other translations. But let me tell you something. The old King James says he was a goodly child. Do you know when that word is also used? In Genesis chapter 1. And what is that Hebrew word in Genesis 1? It says, God said he saw that it was good. Or it was very good. That's what this mother sees when she sees that little boy. Now, he is not her first. She has an older daughter. And she's got an older son. We know him as Aaron. And he's 3 years older. I'm not sure how much older Miriam is. I'm thinking that she's probably maybe a teenager. I mean, she knows a little bit about, how babies are fed and those types of things. We'll see that in a little bit. But when he comes along, she looks at this little boy and she says, he's special. Now again, as my Aunt Wanda said, every blackbird thinks their babies are blackest. Jochebed's holding that baby and she's thinking, that's a wonderful, wonderful child. And she was right. But can I tell you that his birth was no different? It was not like the birth of Jesus that was foretold. It was not something spectacular where that a virgin conceived and bore a son. This was an average birth that was taking place among the many thousands of slaves that were under bondage in the nation of Egypt. And so you've got this mother and she is holding this little baby. And she says he's a goodly child. And she keeps him hidden. We'll get to that in our second point in a moment. But she keeps him hidden for 3 months. This week as I was thinking about this and how that she needed to keep it quiet, I thought about a little song that I used to sing to my kids. And to be honest with you, I looked up the words this week and I can't remember them today, just like I couldn't remember them when I sang them to my kids. So I would make up words. Hush, little baby, don't you cry. Papa's gonna buy you a mockingbird. And if that mockingbird don't sing, Papa's gonna buy you a diamond ring. And I know that some of those words are already wrong, but you know the song. Oh, you know it. You may have sang it to your kids yourself. And she's holding that little baby up close to her breast. And she's going, hush, little baby, don't you cry. And she's trying to keep him as quiet as she can. But can I tell you something? There comes a time when a kid's not going to hush. They're going to get loud. And so you've got this mother. And she comes from a good place. So what does she do? After 3 months, she says, I'm going to have to put him in the hands of God. And can I tell you, that's exactly what we do. We put our children in the hands of God for those people that know the Lord. Every one of the children that Debbie and I had before they ever left the hospital, it was almost always, probably that very first day, when we would pray together, we would commit that child to the Lord. Lord, this baby is dedicated to you. Whenever we have babies that are usually within a year or two old or under, we'll have a baby dedication day. We don't always do that because some people are backslidden and don't have kids quick enough. I think you got the gist of what I'm trying to say today, all right? And so we will have baby dedication day. Now, that doesn't save that baby, but it lets that baby know that my mom and dad want God in my life when they get older and they see those certificates and they see those pictures and they see those videos that parents have taken. They know my parents want God in my life, and that's a big deal. Because if it's important to mom and daddy, it's important to the children in most cases till they get to be teenagers. And so you've got this woman, and what does she do? She knows she cannot hide this baby. Why does she need to hide the baby? Let's go to point number two. I want you to see the godless threat. Now, she has had this baby, but there's a background. Go back to chapter 1. And you begin in verse number 9. You've got the Pharaoh, and he is concerned that the Israelites are having babies at such a tremendous rate that their population is going to overtake the Egyptian population, that they may rise up in some type of rebellion, and instead of being good slaves, they will become rebellious slaves. And so we see that he's concerned about that. And so what does he do? He says to the taskmasters, verse number 11, he said, afflict them with their burden. He goes on to say that you need to beat them, put more on them. And he said, if you will do that, he said, maybe what they'll do, he said, they'll be so tired that they'll not be able to procreate. They'll not be able to have any type of energy for procreation. And so you've got him, and he does that. And so he sees that that is not working. So he puts it on them harder. In other words, instead of giving them the straw, you go gather your own straw, and you still got to make so many bricks for all of these pyramids that we're building. You got to do all of that. Then he goes to the midwives, and he says, now look, now by the way, there's some people, and I kind of lean this way, there's some people that think that these midwives are not necessarily Hebrew midwives, that they may be Egyptian midwives. And there's a couple of reasons for that, but I'm not chasing that rabbit this morning because of time. You've got these midwives, and he says to them, now, when those women give birth, when they're between the stones, evidently that was it was the way that they would put their feet up on stones. And when those women would deliver, they would say, if it's a girl, she lives. If it's a boy, throw it or kill it. Take care of it. But it says that the midwives feared God. Now, one of the things that I am amazed at in this whole text here is the specific times that women are used of God and the men are nowhere to be found. You think about this. When God wanted to save Moses' life, the midwives were under instruction from the man, Pharaoh. When he said it, it happened. Except in this case, it did not happen. And so God used the midwives to disobey. Who else did God use? God used Jochebed. She refused to obey. God also used Pharaoh's daughter. She didn't obey her father. And then you even had Moses' older sister, probably a young teenager, named Miriam, and she disobeyed the Pharaoh. So you've got four different times that either an individual woman or a group of women defied the Pharaoh. And can I tell you that it is more right to obey God than it is man? When you fear God, you don't have to fear men. The fear of the Lord is where everything starts. Isn't it a compliment when somebody says, well, that woman right there, she's a God-fearing woman. That's a compliment. Well, that man right there, he's a God-fearing man. Yeah, that's a great compliment. Because when you fear the Lord, you don't have to worry about anybody else because he's top of the totem pole. And so you've got this godless threat that has happened. And so what does she do? She turns basically her son over to the Lord. Now the question is this: why was Moses to be killed, but her three-year-old son Aaron was not to be killed? Well, there's some people think that they had been hearing rumblings that there was going to be a king that would be born among the Israelites. And this king would be born at a certain time, and when he grew up, he would be the one to throw the yoke off. So they weren't concerned about the boys that were already living. They were concerned about the ones that were now coming along. And so you have Jochebed, and she takes that little baby that's 3 months old. He's probably not the size of Charlie, but about that same age. And she takes a basket. It's a basket made of what we would call papyri. It's a plant that would be used and dried. And then she would take that, and it's called an ark. It is a Hebrew word that has the idea of a boat that is watertight. We know that from Genesis chapter 6 through Genesis chapter 9 in the story of who? Noah. Noah was in an ark, and he was saved. And now Moses is in a little baby ark, and he is saved. Now, as a kid for years, I used to think that when she put him in the river, the Nile River, that he was just miles and miles away. I don't believe that anymore. I think that when she put him in the Nile River, she put him in a specific place where that the currents were not going to take him away. I think that she just wanted to make sure he was secure, but she left him in the hands of the Lord. And you say, why do you say that? Because she says to his older sister, the teenager, hey, you go and you stand and you watch that ark. And that's exactly what Miriam does. And so you've got this lady, and she says, God, I've gone as far as I can go without somebody really finding him. Would you protect my baby? And does God ever do it? Third thing this morning is God's timing. God's timing. Now, think about the timing of God, not just in this story, but in every story. I am amazed in my own life at the time that God has come in and protected me, opened up this door, closed that door. I am amazed at the timing of God. All his trains run on time. He's never late. He's right there when we need him at the moment that we need him. We find that in our text here. If you look at chapter 2, beginning in verse number 5, it says that the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash. Now, the washing here may not have been like we would call a regular bath. My guess is that her being the daughter of Pharaoh, she probably had an indoor tub where that the slaves would fill it and she could bathe inside. A lot of people think this is a ritual washing for her religion. I lean that way myself. And so you've got her, and she is there in the river with all of those gods of the river. You remember the plagues and the things that would come out of the Nile? All of those were deities that they would worship. You would have the frogs. You would have the crocodiles. All of those were deities in ancient Egypt. And so she is there performing some type of ritual with her washing. But all of a sudden, that baby cries. The Lord reaches down and takes his big toe and squeezes it, and he cries. And she sends one of her maidens over into the reeds to get that basket. They look in it, and what does she say? She said, it is one of the Hebrews. Now, how does she know that? Not by color. It could have been by circumcision. We don't know that precisely, but it could have been that. Later on, that would be the mark that would be different than everybody else. Among the peoples of the earth, the Jews practiced it. Non-Jews did not practice it. The Egyptians were not practicing the rite of circumcision, but it could have been that God's people way back in the land of Goshen maybe even had done that, and then it would just been continued in the law of Moses when he got bigger. So you've got her, and she sees this little baby, and what happens? Maternal instincts. Bet you to a dollar to a donut. If we had a group of women, and we had a group of men, and somebody came in and they had a little baby and said, would somebody like to hold this baby? You know who's going to hold that baby? Those men aren't going to go, yeah, give me that baby. Before they could ever speak, there would be women stepping forward, let me hold that baby. Let me hold her. Let me hold him. And they would rock that baby and they would walk around just like Debbie does and just like you have done 1,000 times. Why? Maternal instincts. There's something about it. Dads don't have it. Doesn't mean they don't love, but they don't have that where they've got to just have that baby up tight. And so you've got this young girl. We don't even know if she had kids. Evidently, she probably did not. But what does she say? She said, it's a Hebrew baby. And in steps the timing of God. Miriam, who has just been told to watch, she sees an opportunity. Maybe the Spirit of God prompted her. But she comes out of where she is at, and she's hearing Pharaoh's daughter. This is a Hebrew baby. And Miriam goes, would you like for me to go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse it? You see, there were a lot of women that had milk, but their babies had been killed. And so that's probably what Pharaoh's daughter's thinking. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, we'll do that. But Miriam, she doesn't just go to get some random mother who has lost her child. She goes back to Jochebed and she says, I want you to come with me. And as they're going, she begins to tell her. And then Pharaoh's daughter looks at her and says, I want you to nurse this baby for me. And if you will nurse this baby for me, I will pay you. Is that not God's timing? Is that not God's sense of humor? Jochebed just gave birth to this baby. She's been feeding this baby for 3 months. Now, you say, well, how long do they naturally feed? Well, there's instances in the Bible where it would be 3 years. You say, that'd be awful. Well, it might be, but I know this. I know that God made it to where that if the breast milk was coming, it would continue to come in instances like that. And you've got Jochebed, and she goes, and all of a sudden, that same little baby that she gave birth to 3 months ago, God has brought him back to her bosom. And for 3 years, she's singing to him, hush, little baby, don't you cry. Listen to every word that your mama says. I just made that up. Or you can read it between the lines in the Hebrew if you want to. All right. Why is she doing that? She is telling him about his God. And what does it say later on about Moses in the book of Hebrews? And by the way, and my time is gone today, but what does it say about her? It talks about her being in the hall of faith in Hebrews 11. And what does it say about Moses? He chose, when he got to be older, now he would be trained in the Egyptian education system. He would be trained in the ways of the palace. I mean, he knew his way around the courtyards. But there was something always inside of that boy. And when he became a man, it finally came out. But what he did was he began to think about the Lord. And it's all because the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. He was not special as far as the world was concerned, but he was a goodly child as far as his mama was concerned. And mamas, the influence that you have on your kids is exponentially great. You and I, we need to never forget that you mamas, you have a great, great, great influence on those babies that God gives you. Years ago, there was a great preacher named Vance Havner. He's dead and in heaven now. But a lady came to him one time and said, "Dr. Havner, I've got a 6-year-old son. When should I begin training him?" He said, "Oh, my lady, hurry home and start." Said, "You're 6 years late. You're 6 years late." And you and I need to understand that the timing of God is always where it needs to be. I close with one final thing. Last thing, this is the words from an old hymn. And I want you to think about this in your life right now. Your kids may be grown. Maybe your grandkids are grown. But I want you to remember that no matter what stage of life you're in, the timing of God is always right. God moves in mysterious ways, His wonders to perform. He plants His footsteps in the seas and rides upon the storm. Deep and unfathomable mines of never-ending or never-failing skill, He treasures up His bright designs and works His sovereign will. God has a plan for this old world, and He's got a plan for you. And what we need to understand is that God's timing is always perfect. Never late, never in a hurry, always able to do exactly what He wants to do. He shows that a million times over in our lives, and He shows it hundreds of times over on the pages of Holy Writ. And so let's understand that Jochebed was defiant to the Pharaoh. "I will not toss my son into the Nile. I won't do that." Now, she didn't say that to his face, but with her actions, she honored God. She feared the Lord, and she was a great lady of faith, and she went down in the annals of our Bibles in Hebrews chapter 11.